Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Be reading from Volume 64, Number 2, the Spring 2025 issue, Surprising Stories, How Primary Sources Bring History to Life. We'll begin today with Surprising Discoveries by Dr. Darren Waters, who is Deputy Secretary of the Office of Archives and History within the North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. One of the most memorable and rewarding experiences of my career as a student and aspiring historian was unexpected. In 2002, I entered the doctoral program in history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with much trepidation. A doctoral program is an advanced level of school where people study for many years after college to learn more about one particular subject. I was the father of two young children, and I had just completed my master's degree in history at North Carolina State University a year earlier. I felt that my two sons' future would be better served by my returning to work full-time. However, family and friends encouraged me to set my worries aside and to continue my graduate studies, and then I was formally accepted into the doctoral program at Chapel Hill. A few years later, I reached the final stages of my doctoral program. It was time for me to select a research topic that, as my dissertation advisor suggested, dissertation is a lengthy research paper required to complete a doctoral program, leading to a PhD, the highest level of academic degree in a subject. My master said that I could gave him a topic that I could live with for a while. My advisor said it was likely to be my first book project as well. With that in mind, I decided to write about the development of the African-American community in Asheville and western North Carolina. Until that time, very little was written about the topic. In fact, the going assumption among many was there were few, if any, African-Americans in the region. The professors on my dissertation committee were generally supportive, but some were concerned that a lack of many known primary sources about black life in western North Carolina might become an obstacle to the completion of the project. Almost miraculously, however, their concern disappeared when the director of the YMI Cultural Center, the Young Men's Institute at Asheville, invited me to participate in a meeting about documenting the history of that organization. The YMI Cultural Center was established in 1893 to support the building efforts of Asheville's African-American community. But I was also intrigued to learn that George Vanderbilt, the owner and developer of Biltmore Estate, provided the initial funding to establish the organization. Given this historical link, it seemed only logical that Biltmore might have records pertaining to the history and operations of the organization. It turned out that Biltmore did indeed have records related to the YMI and its archives, and to my surprise, these records included some information about other matters related to the history of African Americans in the region. At the estate's invitation, I spent 6 months examining records that revealed much about Vanderbilt and his relationship with the city's African American community. In addition to his support of the YMI, records show that he provided support to other community-related efforts among African Americans in Asheville. For example, he helped develop the infrastructure of the community of Shiloh, a historically African American community. It was originally established on land that Vanderbilt purchased to build his estate. Estate's records also reveal that Vanderbilt gave financial support to the educational efforts of other African American residents. Some went on to make significant contributions in other communities. As important as these findings were, I discovered something even more astonishing. records pertaining to my great-grandfather, Lewis Waters. Lewis was born in 1860, so neither I nor my father were privileged to know Lewis. What we did know of him, however, was that he eventually owned a successful apple farm in Edneyville, North Carolina. The discovery of Lewis's connection to Biltmore really happened by chance. During my first day at the Biltmore Archive, the estate's archivist and I were discussing our family histories. When I mentioned Lewis's name, the archivist suggested we enter his name in the database to see if there might be any references to him. Although skeptical, I went along with the suggestion. Much to my surprise, the search found several references to a Lewis Waters. And those references turned out to be letters written by what further research would confirm to be my great-grandfather. The letters were addressed to the estate manager and attorney Charles McNamee. The letters revealed that Lewis was an independent contractor. Along with a crew of men he managed, he worked to remove debris from the site where the Vanderbilt home was constructed. Even before making this discovery, I had often wondered about my great-grandfather's life. He was born a year before the start of the American Civil War, so I had wondered if he had been able to obtain an education. Western North Carolina experienced geographic isolation for many years after the war. Educational opportunities for African Americans, many of whom only recently been emancipated from slavery, may have been few. Lewis's letters, which were written in the 1890s, reveal that he was not only an educated man, but also an entrepreneur. He quite possibly used the money that he earned working at Biltmore to purchase his apple farm. That first day in the Biltmore Archive turned out to be an inspirational one for me. Today I work for the state of North Carolina as Deputy Secretary of the Office of Archives and History. I work regularly with the curators, educators, and other staff at the North Carolina Museum of History. The discovery that I made that day at Biltmore reinforced for me the importance of the work that goes into maintaining the documents that serve to illuminate our past. Here are the captions to the accompanying photographs. The author at Biltmore Estate, where his research led to surprising discoveries about his family history. A portrait of Emmer and Lewis Waters, made in the 1800s, the late 1800s. Lewis Waters owned his own business and led a crew of workers that hauled debris away from the site of the Biltmore House's construction. A view of Biltmore House going up from the south terrace. The group of people in the left corner includes George Vanderbilt, who loved showing off the construction of his house to friends and family. This photo, taken December 22, 1894, shows Biltmore House toward the end of construction. On May 30, 1895, Lewis Waters asked Estate Superintendent Charles McNamee for an advance of $15, which is about $570 in today's money. The stamp at the top of the letter documents the place and date the letter was received. A letter from Lewis Waters to Estate Superintendent Charles McNamee dated February 25, 1893, asking for another job on the estate. Lewis Waters, writing to Charles McNamee on July 30, 1893, asking for his assistance in purchasing land from someone. The exhibition Building Biltmore House, installed in 2022, included the story of Lewis Waters, Dr. Darren Waters' great-grandfather, and Dr. Waters with his son Jonathan at the Biltmore exhibition. Next article, Primary Sources, Personal Stories, Gertrude Weil and the Letters That Saved Lives. This is written by Brooke Suka, who is Section Chief of Editorial and Graphic Design at the North Carolina Museum of History. Imagine finding a dusty old letter that alters everything you thought you knew about a person or historical event. That's what happened when I started researching Gertrude Weil, one of North Carolina's most famous social activists. An activist is a person who works to bring about change in society, often by advocating for a particular cause or issue that they care deeply about. You may have heard of her, perhaps in history class or even in previous issues of this magazine. A Goldsboro native, Gertrude spent her life fighting for systemic change. Systemic change is change to how a whole system works, like a school, a community, or even a country, not by fixing or changing one small part. From leading the North Carolina Equal Suffrage League in 1920 to advocating for labor reforms and civil rights. When you visit the state archives in North Carolina to explore her papers, you'll find extensive records about her activism. But you'll also find something more unexpected. Letters from her Jewish relatives living in Nazi-controlled Europe during the Holocaust. The Holocaust was a time before and during World War II, which went from 1933 to 1945, when millions of Jewish people, along with other marginalized groups, were persecuted and killed by the Nazis, a political party in Europe. Nazis were a member of a German political party that controlled Germany from 1933 to 1945 under Adolf Hitler. It was one of the darkest times in history, and we study it to make sure nothing like it ever happens again. Many Jewish people tried to flee to safer countries like the United States. Gertrude and her sister, Mina, knew their relatives were in danger. So they decided to help by sponsoring them to guarantee their entry into the United States. Through their letters, you can trace many of these relatives' desperate journeys to safety. One of those stories hidden in these letters is that of Otto Julius Birnbaum. Born in Vienna, the capital of the country Austria, on September 11, 1913, Otto was a traveling businessman by the onset of World War II. He spoke several languages, including English, and was a distant relative of the Weil family. Otto's journey began in March 1938 with a letter from Anna Rosenbaum, a cousin, who wrote to Mina, "There is also Mizzi's son Otto, 24 years of age, who would like to leave for America. I ask you if your children may be so good as to procure him an affidavit, because otherwise he cannot possibly be admitted in America." An affidavit is a statement in writing that is sworn to be true. Despite being ill, Mina responded to Anna's letter and began corresponding with Otto directly. Meanwhile, Gertrude wrote to several agencies seeking advice on how to help her relatives like Otto immigrate to the United States. To immigrate is to move from one's home country to another country with the intention of living there permanently or for a long time. American sponsors of immigrants were required to submit notarized documents of income, property, and other assets to provide evidence that the sponsored emigre would not require financial assistance from the government. It wasn't easy work, and it took time to secure and submit all the required documents. In June 1938, Otto pleaded with Mina to quickly send the documents he needed. "You can't imagine how urgent for me it is to get the affidavit soon, because we can't know what will happen the next day. Every Jew is in danger to be imprisoned. Every day the war is possible to break out. If the affidavit will not come sick in a short time, it will come sick too late." SIC, or sick, is a Latin word that means thus or so, used in writing, especially when quoting historical documents, to indicate that a word or phrase is being quoted exactly as it was originally written, even if it contains an error. After some effort, Gertrude and Mina succeeded in securing the documents Otto needed. He happily announced in a July letter that the consulate had received the affidavit. He wrote he planned to leave the country immediately once his visa was approved. "I'm very happy to meet you in a short time and to be able to thank you by myself for all that you have done for me," he wrote, relieved to be on his way to safety. Otto's next letter is written on Red Star Line stationery, which was provided to voyagers on the steamship Westerland. Imagine the relief Gertrude and Mina must have felt when they saw the Red Star Line symbol on this paper. "I am happy to be able to tell you," Otto wrote, "that I arrived this morning in New York." By the time Otto sent another letter in October, he had landed an advertising job in New York City and hoped to visit the Wilde family in North Carolina. His story, like many others, was one of luck and timing. He was one of the fortunate to escape the Holocaust, in large part because his cousins had the means to help him. His journey to the United States was also exceptionally quick. Most other hopeful immigrants waited months or years for their visas. Gertrude and Mina didn't stop at helping Otto. They sponsored about a dozen people in total. Even after Mina's death in 1940, Gertrude continued to assist her European family. Some, like Otto's mother, Mizzi, arrived safely in America. These letters, saved by Gertrude and later by the State Archives in North Carolina, remind us that behind big historical events are real people with real stories. Because she saved the letters, we can see how Gertrude and Mina's compassion changed lives during one of the darkest times in history. This may not be the story you'd expect to find in Gertrude Wilde's letters, but it is an invaluable piece of history that expands what we thought about North Carolina's favorite suffragist. So dive into original research. What hidden stories might you uncover? What legacies will you bring to light? The answers are waiting for those who dare to research. Here are the captions accompanying this article. Gertrude Wilde, date unknown. The first letter about Otto Birnbaum from Mina's cousin Anna. She also referenced the changes the Nazis brought to Australia in 1938, writing, "I suppose you know what happened here lately. I am unable to write anything of it." The entire letter is reproduced on a full page of the magazine, so I'm going to go ahead and read it. Vienna, March 24, 1938. "Dearest Mina, I thank you very much for your present, and I don't really know how to express you my gratitude. I am so very glad that I can help a little Mitzi. Thereby, unfortunately, her husband does not yet feel better. I hope you are all very well, dear Mina, you and your dear children. I suppose you know what happened here lately. I am unable to write anything of it, as it is too exciting for me. If possible, we shall all leave from here. There is also Mitzi's son, Otto, 24 years of age, a very good-natured and active young man who would like to leave for America, as he has no possibility whatever to earn anything here now. I should therefore ask you, dear Mina, that your children may be so good as to procure him an affidavit, because otherwise he cannot possibly be admitted in America. He will gather agencies for America here, and by this way he will be able to earn his living there without importunating you. Will you please think this over and let me know whether you can see your way to help him? You would do a real good work by it. I have this letter written in English so your children might be able to read it. Wishing you best health very heartily and with many regards to you and your young and your dear children, I remain forever your very grateful cousin, Anna Rosenbaum." Here's another caption of a photograph, "Jewish refugee children waving at Statue of Liberty as the SS President Harding steams into New York Harbor on June 3, 1939. These children were among a group of 50 Jewish refugees, 25 boys and 25 girls, aged 5 to 14 from Vienna, Austria. They were on their way to Philadelphia, where they would be placed with foster families. Otto sent this photo of himself to Gertrude and Mina while trying to immigrate to the United States before World War II. Otto presented this letter to the cousins on Red Line Stationery. He penned this letter to his cousins on Red Line Stationery once he arrived in New York. Also, there's another letter. This urgent letter from Otto described how desperately he needed an affidavit to immigrate to the United States. He also shared the risks and other Jewish people in Vienna faced after the Nazis seized control. The Red Star Line letter is handwritten, but the like the previous letter that I read, the urgent letter is typed, so I'm going to read that. It's from Vienna, June 4th, 1938. Dear Aunt Mina, thank you so much for your kind letter of May 16th. You can't imagine how urgent for me it is to get the affidavit as soon as because we don't know what will happen the next day. I hope you have finished the matter in the meantime. Please don't be angry that I press you so much, but we are here so nervous and every day is in danger to be imprisoned. For instance, the least 4 days, more than 5,000 were delivered up in prison. Beside, every day the war is possible to break out, and in this case, nobody will be able to leave country. Also, there is not a possibility for me to work since 3 months. I hope you will understand my situation, and as thankfully to Gertrude and Elizabeth, but I am angry that if the affidavit not came in a short time, it will come too late. Give my love to all your family, your cousin, Otto. Next, a closer look. Surprising stories from primary sources. We're going to start, before we go to the primary sources, with the Think About It sidebar article. Did you know the North Carolina Museum of History has more than 150,000 artifacts in our collection? Most of these objects could be considered primary sources. They help us learn about people, daily life, events, and other moments of history. How do we decide what artifacts to collect? To make those tough decisions, we ask some key questions. Does the object tell a North Carolina story? Is it in good condition? Do we already have a similar object? Will the object be useful for exhibitions, programs, or research? Now ask yourself these questions. What do you think are some other good reasons to add an artifact to our museum collection? Look around your house or school. Can you find something that would make an interesting artifact to include in a museum collection? So the first artifact today is a miniature ox cart from somewhere between 1970 and 1980. Do you bring home souvenirs when you travel to new places? This one belonged to Luis G. Lobo. He was born in Costa Rica and moved to Lincolnton as a young boy with his family. In the mid-1970s, on a trip to Costa Rica, Luis purchased this decorated cart as a souvenir to bring back to his new home in North Carolina. Is it a primary source? Well, you might think from the details that it is a life-size cart, but it's much smaller. It's only 3.5 feet long by 2 feet wide by 2 feet tall. But it represents one of Costa Rica's national symbols, ox carts or carretas. Traditionally, the large, brightly painted carretas were pulled by oxen and used to transport goods like coffee, the country's main export. Today, the carts are mostly used during celebrations and in art. But Lewis's souvenir documents what was popular with tourists in the 1970s, and it also tells the story of how this symbol of the country's culture helped a new North Carolinian hold on to his heritage. An electric permanent wave machine from somewhere between 1920 and 1930. Did you read this issue's What's That on the back cover? Did you guess what this weird-looking artifact is? It's an electric permanent wave machine for hair. Beauty shop owner Mrs. Hank Hanna of Dunn owned and used this machine in the 1920s. We wanted to see what the machine looked like when it was actually being used. So we searched the Library of Congress prints and photographs collection online and found this photo. Fun fact, that's Norma Smallwood, Miss America 1926, getting her hair curled. We also found her mentioned in an article in the Tulsa World newspaper, which wrote, "Judges were mystified by her beauty and charmed by her wonderful name, which she wore even when hooked up to this gizmo." Hair jewelry, circa 1850s. Today, friendship bracelets made of colorful beads are popular items to make and trade. Before that, friendship bracelets knotted from colored embroidery thread were a big fad with kids in the 1990s, especially at summer camps. But in the mid-1800s to the early 1900s, making jewelry out of hair was all the rage. Some hair creations memorialized people who had died, but many jewelry makers used their own hair or that of living friends and relatives to craft bracelets, necklaces, and rings. Curators say this bracelet is associated with the Tate family of Burke County. The initials engraved on the inside of the clasp, A.E. Pearson, might refer to Ann Elizabeth Pearson, a cousin of Samuel McDowell Tate. Tiny Broadwick jumpsuit, circa 1920 to 1925. Georgia Tiny Broadwick was a poor, uneducated mill girl from Oxford, but she became a brave pioneer in the early days of aviation. One day she saw Charles Broadwick's world-famous aeronauts at a carnival and was soon performing with them. At age 15, she made her first parachute jump from a hot air balloon. In 1913, at age 20, she made history as the first woman to parachute out of an airplane. Tiny is credited with inventing the ripcord, which lets a person open their parachute by hand. Her invention helped make flying safer for pilots heading into World War I. Tiny made more than 1,100 jumps before retiring in 1922. In 1963, she donated several of her parachuting artifacts to the Museum of History, including a jumpsuit and a parachute. These are important primary sources that document the history of the early days of flight. And her jumpsuit shows that she lived up to her name. It's tiny, too. She weighed only 80 pounds and stood just shy of 5 feet. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.
I need an ocean for my soul and ground for my bed. I need a home for the heart. I need these hills for my head. An ocean for my soul and ground for my bed. I need a home for the heart. I need these hills for the head.